thanks for your attention again. I hope you enjoyed that a really terrific panel. Thanks to the panelists. I thought some real insights and really diverse opinions too. That's always what makes it interesting. My presentation this year is on what's different about postseason baseball. And I really posed the question of what's different about postseason baseball because I wanted to objectively categorize some of those differences and see if it could help us understand them better and really what the implications of what's different about postseason baseball might mean for teams assembling rosters and the like. And I felt if I focused on the true differences in the postseason that I might be able to better understand the characteristics or traits of teams or players that are likely to be more successful in October. What I'm going to share with you today really is just sort of the, to use the cliche, the tip of the iceberg, but it's really just a snapshot overview of what's different about postseason baseball. One of the clear things that you understand when you look at the data, and certainly in this instance, I believe the data confirms a lot of what we observe, is that less runs are scored in the postseason. It's a lower run scoring environment. In fact, if you looked at the last 10 years and you looked at the amount of runs scored, it's about 8.5% less in the postseason than it is in the regular season. Now, that's not accounting for the difference in the teams. Frankly, the teams that are in the postseason are typically higher run scoring teams. But even if you look at that, the average runs per game of the postseason is 8.3% lower than the average runs per game of all 30 teams in the regular season. So I have a feeling this 8.3% decline kind of understates the decline. When you think about why, one of the reasons that it's radically different is the quality of pitching that we see in the postseason. And I think we all say instinctively and intuitively, boy, the pitching in the postseason is better, okay? It's better for two reasons. Number one, the teams with better pitching are more likely to get to the postseason, okay? But that's only a part of it. Part number two is the fact that pitching is deployed completely differently in the postseason. And so think of it this way. You can't do anything to get Mike Trout or Miguel Cabrera to the plate more than 1-9 times. In fact, the most you could do is maybe move them up to number 2 in the batting order. They're probably already hitting 3 or 4. Maybe you lead them off if you really want to be dramatic about it. Yeah, you might get 2 extra plate appearances in the entire postseason by doing that. So essentially, it's a 1-9. However, you start deploying your pitching differently like we've seen in recent years in the postseason opportunistically to get your best pitchers on the mound in high leverage situations, and you begin to magnify and amplify this this concentration of pitching in the postseason. So, one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to actually measure this. In fact, you saw on my previous slide that the top 40% of pitchers pitch 63% of the postseason innings, and I'll explain what I mean in a minute. So the way I measured the quality of pitching in the postseason is I went back to the regular season, and I looked at OPS against for all pitchers, actually all starting pitchers, excuse me. The reason I omitted relievers is some of them had 40, 50 innings, and I didn't want to start classifying the quality of relievers based on reputation. I wanted to do it based on a statistic, and the stat I chose, for better or worse, is OPS against, the OPS that they yielded while they're on the mound. So what I did was I simply arrayed all starting pitchers' OPS. So from a guy like Chris Sale, who might have a 520 OPS against, to a guy who, I'll pick on the Yankees' new acquisition, Nathan Eovaldi, perhaps, who might have an 840 OPS against him. So basically, if you array them and then you look at the number of innings in a season and simply take the first 20% of the innings, working from the top of the list down, that's my definition of the top quintile of pitchers. The guys who fall into the second quintile, okay, the next 20% of all major league innings is my second quintile, and so on. And the guys at the bottom of the list are the guys who are in the fifth quintile. Now, keep in mind, I profiled every pitcher and rated them into a quintile based on the handedness of the batter. So C.C. Sabathia might have been in the second quintile for left-handed pitchers against left-handed hitters, but he might have been in the third quintile for left-handed pitchers against right-handed hitters, okay? So basically, if you divide all this up for the regular season, then you look at who logs the postseason innings. You get a pie chart that looks something like this. So basically, the top 20% of major league pitchers, as measured by OPS against, actually get 36% of the postseason innings. And meanwhile, keep in mind, a lot of these guys aren't even in the postseason, right? But they still get 36% of the postseason innings. And the second 20% get 28% of the postseason innings. And if you look down to the last two quintiles, you know, they're kind of the fourth and fifth starters. They're not getting a lot of work. Some of them might have pitched in relief, which I did count relief innings. But the bottom 40% of the league's pitching gets just a mere 17% of postseason innings. So the net result of this is that, you know, you index at a quality level of about 160 to 165 for the postseason. Now, I think another illustration of this is, let's use a specific example of the 2009 postseason. You may remember the Yankees won the World Series that year. Now, they did it in an interesting fashion. They used only three starters the entire postseason. They were able to win some short series, some sweeps, which gave them extra days off, and just the scheduling of days off happened to favor them that year. So the three starters, Sabathia, Burnett, and Pettit, logged 61% of their starting pitcher regular season innings and 100% of their starting pitcher postseason innings. If you add in their top two relievers that year, which were, of course, Rivera, and if you remember, Phil Hughes was in the bullpen that year and had a tremendous year in the bullpen. If you add those two in, those five pitchers logged 81% of all of the Yankees' postseason innings, not just World Series, but the whole postseason. Those same guys logged 54% of the regular season innings. So again, this is an illustration of the kind of concentration we see of top pitching in the postseason. How about this year? Madison Bumgarner throws 15% of the Giants' regular season innings, total innings that is, and he throws 33% of their total innings in the postseason. So again, there's that 2.2 to 1 ratio of concentrating your top pitching. So beyond pitching, which is one factor, I think we can make the argument that defense is more important in October because you're dealing in a lower run scoring environment. So, you know, teams that go deep into the playoffs tend to have a stronger defense. If you look at the last 10 seasons, if you look at the teams that got to the LCS and beyond, so the Final Four, if you will, each year in Major League Baseball, they averaged a ranking of number 10 defensively across all of Major League Baseball. So they were essentially in the top third of all teams. So, you know, you may say, well, gee, if they're great pitching and they have really good offense, maybe they would give something back on the defensive side of the ball, but not true. They're actually premium defensive teams. And again, in the lower run scoring environment, I think you could understand why that would be potentially more important. The third factor that I think, and it's tough to quantify, and I didn't attempt to, about the postseason, I think that makes it unique, is the need for really a different approach from managing in-game. You know, one of the things that we think about players having roles, there's really two reasons why players have roles. One is to give the player a level of certainty and clarity around how he'll be used. And there's a certain peace of mind associated with that. So that's an important piece. But the other piece that we define roles is we want to sort of pick how we're going to use our players so that we can stage them to get through the 162-game season. So it's really about preservation. It's really about the marathon versus the postseason, which is much more of a sprint. So what you end up finding and seeing is some of the best postseason teams and the best postseason managers, and I think it's pretty prevalent today, is you'll see them say, hey, when we get to the postseason, all bets are off. You certainly saw it with what Bochy did with his pitching this year, and it wasn't just with Bumgarner. It was opportunistically using other guys and getting starters out in the second inning when they didn't look like they had their stuff. And so I think this notion of being willing to deploy the assets on a real-time basis and as needed in high-leverage situations, and forgetting who your setup guy is, forgetting who your closer might be, forgetting who your number four starter is. How about the year 2 years ago when the Giants used Lincecum as a super reliever coming out of the four hole and because he wasn't going to start? So basically, I think this is the third factor. So, you know, you could say, well, wait a minute. Didn't you just describe all good teams? And I don't think I did. And in fact, let me give you an example. What kind of a 90-win team, a team that might win 90 games, that was constructed in what manner, would I say would be disadvantaged in the postseason? And it would be a team like this. It would be a team that has great pitching depth, okay? Maybe no top-of-the-rotation guy or two. You know, and I would say just from this attribute, and I'm not saying across the board, but just from this attribute, the Red Sox sitting here today might be in this position. They've got really good pitching depth, but they could be one ace away from having the right or the best formula to really be successful in October. Secondly, beyond the pitching depth, which you really can't leverage in the postseason very easily, I would say that a team that maybe was very offensive oriented and had had some power bats, and maybe they won games by out hitting their opponent, and maybe they had a high strikeout rate at the plate. And then finally, let's say they were mediocre defensively. Could a team constructed this way win 90-plus games and make the postseason? Absolutely. Would I think that they would have a good chance in the postseason? I wouldn't be inclined to bet on them. Obviously, in a series of short series, anything could happen in five-game series or seven-game series. But I'm just saying, in terms of the probabilities, I think they favor teams that have the other mix that I just discussed. So, really, from this point, I wanted to take this to another level, okay, in terms of, you know, peeling that onion back one more layer. And I wanted to understand, are there certain hitters that fare better against top pitching? Because that's what we see in the postseason is top pitching. So I looked at those five quintiles of pitchers, and I looked at every hitter in baseball for a four-year period, 2009 to 2012, and for the regular season now, so I had a robust sample size, I looked at how hitters hit against the top two quintiles, top pitching, and the bottom two quintiles, sort of bottom or weaker pitching. And again, I only use starters in here because I didn't want to classify relievers as top or middle or bottom based on a limited number of innings pitched. And I looked at the average major league performance against each tier, and then I profiled each hitter versus this average to see whether he performed disproportionately well against top pitching or disproportionately poorly against top pitching. So what I found was that this is what the slope looked like in terms of how they hit against best pitching, about a 640 OPS and about an 820 OPS against the worst pitching. This is the league on average, all players. So there's about a 180-point spread on average in terms of how someone performs against a top pitcher and how they perform against the bottom of the heap, so to speak, pitcher. Now, what I then did was I started looking at players individually and see how they arrayed against these pitchers. And again, keep in mind, I controlled for platoon splits. So the reason why someone's gap is narrower is not because he faced more off-handed pitchers, which gave him an advantage, because I controlled for that. So what I found was, here's a guy, Yadier Molina, just a mere 52-point spread instead of the 180-point spread. Now forget about the quality of hitter he is. The point I'm making here is that he doesn't differentiate very much between top pitching and weaker pitching. Now you could argue, it's interesting, you could say, well, gee, what's he doing wrong against weak pitching? I suppose you can look at it that way. But the other side of that coin, of course, is what is he doing positively to neutralize top pitchers? Now, let me give you another example. Here's Curtis Granderson. Okay, now Granderson's slope. So basically, what you're looking for in these players is if your slope is steep, that means you feast on weak pitching. If your slope is flat, that means you are able to neutralize better pitchers and perform well against better pitchers. But you can see Granderson, and this is over 4 years of data. For Granderson, I would have probably 800, 900 plate appearances divided between top pitching and bottom pitching. And the rest of his plate appearances would be in the middle third quintile, which I don't use, or against relievers who are not in my mix. Okay, so pretty decent sample size. Another guy is Josh Hamilton. He's really one of the extremes of guys who really feast on weak pitching. In fact, I went back because in this data set is Josh Hamilton's MVP year. So I was curious. The year he really tore it up, I wondered, well, maybe that's the year he really did do well against top pitching. Well, the reality is you can see his average against the bottom tier pitching is about, 1,100 OPS. The year he won the MVP award, he hit 1,400 OPS against the bottom tier and hit no better than the low sevens there, I guess it is, against top pitching, which was interesting. He might have gotten I control for the mix too. So it's not about a more favorable mix of weak pitching in a given year. So the reality is he just really did much better against poor pitching. Now, more on the positive side, Derek Jeter, the much maligned shortstop for the Yankees, former, has an 80-point spread. So here's a guy. So what I'm really getting at is, and I'll show some evidence, I use the word loosely in a moment, do players with the flat lines, okay, and by the way, flatlining in this is good, not like it would be at an emergency room, but so basically do the flat lines translate their game better into the postseason? And so again, you can see Jeter. So, you know, the other thing you might be wondering here, well, is there a pattern about better hitters? Is the difference between a good hitter and a not as good hitter is they just crush weak pitching. So as the line moves up, because that's a higher OPS guy, will they just have a steeper slope? So just in case you were thinking that, there's Carlos Beltran. Okay, so Beltran, and again, this is 09 to 12. So Beltran had a very tight 88-point spread between how he hits top pitching and how he hits weaker pitching, despite being a very high OPS guy. And then I have to throw in Alex Rodriguez, the obligatory Rodriguez mention. So Rodriguez had about a 277-point spread over those 4 years, and so it's hard to conclude much other than he tended, you would say, to, given the league average is 180, he tended to do better against weaker pitching, disproportionately better against weaker pitching. So what's interesting is if you look at the three guys who had the steeper slopes, and you looked at their regular season, this is their actual stats now, regular season OPS and postseason OPS, you'll see 112-point drop-off for A-Rod, a 50-point drop-off or so for Granderson. By the way, when I did this a couple years ago, the drop-off for Granderson was huge because his regular season OPS was much higher. So he hasn't been in the postseason recently in a couple of years, but his regular season numbers have come down to make this gap a little narrower. So it's really not even apples to apples. And then with Hamilton, almost a 200-point difference between his regular season OPS and his postseason. On the other side of the scale, and I realize I'm dealing with six data points here, so I'm not trying to be overly conclusive from this. You've got Molina, who drops off just 22 points, and then Jeter and Beltran, who actually up their game in the postseason versus the regular season. Okay, so it's kind of interesting. And then here's the chart for all of the guys on the list, and just to get a peek at their OPS against the different tiers, and again the spreads that I talked about on the previous page. So really the next layer of analysis is to take this and you know, just dabbling in this, working with my friends at Cray, the supercomputer company, who I've, you know, partnered with on a number of initiatives. You might have seen the pitch clustering work I did 2 years ago, and even some of the team chemistry work I did last year, I partnered with them. And on this, what we did was we took a look at how what we might learn from HitFX data extending this analysis. So what we did was we took a group of about 40 or 45 top guys who hit disproportionately well, call them flat, and then the same number of guys who were steep. And we looked at a couple of different variables. In this slide I'm going to show you, we looked at hit velocity on the vertical axis and contact point where around the plate. We're talking about with the pitch coming in out in front of the plate versus deep in the zone. So let me explain how this chart reads. So the hit velocity, I should say, is on the vertical axis. So basically, the higher velocity of the speed of the ball coming off the bat is up, and the lower velocity of the speed off the bat is down. The orange, or the lighter colored circles, are the top hitters, the flatter hitters, the ones who hit disproportionately well against top pitching. The blue represent the ones, the Josh Hamilton group, who hit disproportionately poorly against top pitching. And what we have is on the contact point, the pitch is coming from that wall over there this way, okay? So what that means is that there's a red vertical line which is about the front of home plate. So what we find is while in both instances people are hitting the ball out in front of the plate, what you do see is that, not by a lot, but what you see is that the top hitters, the ones who do really well against good pitching, tend to hit the ball a little bit deeper into the zone, okay? If you really take a close look, you find that the lower left here is where you tend to see the better hitters, the guys who do well against top pitching, a little bit more clustered. Again, it's not dramatic. But also an interesting thing to note, the velocity of the ball off the bat of the better hitters is actually lower. So this is an interesting finding, and again, we'd have to go a lot deeper to validate this, but it sort of speaks to the fact that it's less about velocity and more about what I'm going to show you on the next slide, which is the vertical launch angle, okay? So let me go to that last slide. So in this slide, again, the same velocity is on the vertical axis, but this time on the horizontal axis. Did I reverse those? Okay, I'm sorry, I'm looking. I've got my next slide up here, so I'm looking at my next slide. I'm sorry. I got them both up. All right, so this is the velocity versus the vertical launch angle. So what you've got is, in the lower left-hand corner, is you've got guys who are more line drive and ground ball hitters versus fly ball hitters, which are up on the basically the top right. And then what you've got is you've got the lower velocity off the bat from the guys who tend to be hit better against top pitching. The other one I described to you a few moments ago is the ball, again, is coming from this side. So you can see that in this chart, some of the better hitters are actually taking the ball deeper into the zone. They're taking it further, closer to the front of home plate. Not by a lot, though, okay, admittedly. But again, the velocity is lower. Is any of this conclusive? No, it's really the tip of the iceberg, and I think we can do a lot more by taking some of this work and driving it through to the HitFX data or any other batted ball data, which will give us a great deal more insight about the reasons for, as I've showed people this data, I mean, the question that always comes up is, what is it about Beltran and Jeter and people like that and Yadier Molina? You know, I did this topic on my radio show on Sirius XM a couple of weeks ago, and I had on the show Mark DeRosa. And I looked at Mark's stats before I brought him on the show because the topic was the postseason, what's different about it. And I found out that now we all know DeRosa, he played 16 years. He He was sort of the Ben Zobrist before Ben Zobrist, right? Can play one of five or six positions, and at the peak of his career was a starting player. Mark hit 358 in the postseason, and he had a 960 or 980 OPS in the postseason. And I said, well, this is great that I'm having him on because I can ask him about this. And he said, let me tell you, he said, I have a very simple and I think lock solid answer for you on why I did so well in the postseason. He said, I batted seventh. He said, and when Adam Wainwright or Justin Verlander's on the mound and they're giving all of their nuanced repertoire to the three and four hitters, they're getting down to me and they're looking for a little bit of a break and they're saying fastball. He said, so I figured out as long as I didn't get behind in the count, I was just going to see a steady diet of fastballs. He even talked about a specific story where he was facing Josh Beckett down in Florida when Beckett was at his peak, and Beckett kept shaking off the catcher, and he stepped out, DeRosa, and he started smiling, saying he wanted to say to the catcher, let him throw the fastball. That's what he's going to throw. That's what he wants to throw. And sure enough, he jumped on the fastball, and you know, good things happen when you know it's coming. He said he was a good fastball hitter, as a lot of guys are. But the point is, he figured out the mental game, and he figured out that there was an advantage to bat. He said that's one of the reasons he said I have so much respect for three and four hitters. Not only are they better, but they also face a different pitcher, because Justin Verlander pitches totally differently to them than he pitches to me, which I thought was an interesting insight. So there's probably something, possibly something there. And maybe when a team can extend, you know, there's been a lot done about batting order and the impact of protection, okay? And there's a lot of studies in the sabermetric community that suggest that protection isn't really a real and doesn't have a material impact. Maybe, though, when you lengthen your lineup with decent hitter after decent hitter, there's something you do to fatigue the pitcher and make him work differently and not give him that chance, even from a mental standpoint, not just physical, where he has to continue to think his way and play the whole game theory thing through with every hitter. It becomes tough. And so, you know, this is a guy, DeRosa, who really capitalized on that. So anyway, that's my presentation for today, a little bit about what's different about the postseason. Thanks.